This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's go and talk about another case that is back in the headlines. Brian Koberger. A week after Brian Koberger.
One of my favorite graphics of yours, by the way.
LeBry is bored. He is. After a week after Brian Koberger filed a handwritten petition claiming he was tricked into confessing four times. Reporters traced his own language back to the true crime book his defense team tried to suppress. The evidence, he says, was hidden from him, was examined by an expert his own lawyers hired. Criminal defense expert Bob Mata is with us, host of Defense Diaries, on what's actually in this filing and the one claim the state cannot afford to ignore. Let's start with Koberger's petition. He says his plea was based on faulty premises that were circumnavigated by a broken plea. The exact phrase, broken plea, it's the title of a shitty book published in April of 26 by Christopher Wickham. The term clumps of hair that Koberger cites as withheld evidence appears in no court filing. It appears in no police record, in no lab report. It appears in the book. He even used the book's language in a statement to the New York Times. Is this petition actually built on fact, or is it built on the work of this author, Christopher Whitcomb, and his conjecture on it, and Koberger is somehow confusing it as fact, or that it somehow lends him to get a trial? What's your take on what Koberger is attempting to do here and where it may go, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't know.
Yeah,
I think that Whitcomb claims that he had access to, you know, the police reports and files. Yeah. I mean, like whether he did or he didn't, I have no idea.
Yeah,
you know, but what I do know is that Brian Koberger stood in front of a judge and in front of the families of those four victims and said, "Yes, I did the things that they're saying that I did." Mm-hmm. And I'm waiving my appellate rights, which creates a massive, massive mountain for this guy to climb in order for him to get a new trial. And, you know, I mean, does that mean that it's an impossibility? No. And he's basically leaning into the one way that it could happen, which is my lawyer fucked me. You know, my lawyer didn't tell me about this evidence. I went in and made a plea agreement not knowing that this evidence existed. So it wasn't knowingly. You know, I didn't have knowledge of those things. So how can that be a knowing plea agreement when there's, in my estimation, exculpatory evidence that exists out there? You know, here's his problem. You know, at this point, he's basically broken privilege. So ultimately what's going to happen, and it depends, you know, I get the sense that Ann Taylor is a defense attorney, you know, and the one thing that we hold sacred as defense attorneys above all else is that our client's privilege, you know, that we're not going to disclose what they tell us. If we destroy that privilege by just turning around and, you know, spilling state secrets or you know, client secrets in this fashion, you know, then that goes away. And then the bedrock of defense work no longer exists. So, but, you know, Ann Taylor is going to have the opportunity to say, well, you know, this is where it really lays. This is what's actually going on. This is what the evidence actually said. This is what I told Brian Koberger, you know, and you know, I personally, I don't think it's going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I see a lot of people out there. Well, I hope he gets a new trial. That way he can get the death penalty. They can kill him. You know, I mean, my position has always been, you're seeing it in real time with him sniveling and whining about how, you know, the other inmates are, you know, constantly torturing his ass through the vents. There ain't nothing worse than living your entire life in a box, baby. I'm telling you, the death penalty is the easy way out.
Yeah.
You have this guy living in a box for 40, 50 years, just getting psychologically R-worded by the other inmates.
Yep.
So he's, man.
Yeah.
Like, I don't give a shit if he gets three squares a day. you're living in a box. Everything that we take for granted every day of our lives on the outside as human beings is all lost. It's all gone. You are living in a box for the rest of your life. Ultimately, if your question is, do I think this thing's going to prevail? No, I don't. I don't think he'll get a new trial off of it. Do I think that it can be litigated? Yes. I think that they will try to litigate it. I think I saw that he was appointed attorneys,
yep.
I believe. So they're going to take a run at it. Ultimately, at the end of the day, impossible and difficult it is to undo a conviction in this country. Well, when you're the guy standing in open court and admitting to doing it, it's even harder. These aren't the ramblings of a man in the throes of psychosis in his jail cell saying, I did it. I think I did it. Evidently, I did it. This is a guy who stood in front of the world, was admonished by the judge as to his rights and claimed that he understood them and still said, I did the things that they said that I did. It's like people wanted the details. And I know that the families wanted to know why. Everyone wants to know why.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are just broken. There is no.
Yeah, he's a sadistic fuck. That's why.
Right. There's
really no other reason.
Exactly.
And Bob, I'm curious about, because again, I'm going to give you props right now. I'm going to tout your John Wayne Gacy podcast, Buried, because you talk about this a lot in how you approach that case and how lawyers approach these cases, because you're looking for facts, you're looking for interviews, you're looking for details. The last thing you did was rely on someone's book, because that means it's subjective, it's deals with publishers. And that's my question on this. So he's using very obviously a book that's a hearsay book that admittedly by the author himself, didn't do any follow-up, didn't conduct any interviews, was given a file by someone who broke a non-disclosure agreement with defense and handed it over to another third party. That reaches the bar for someone to take a look at this case again?
I don't think it does. I don't think it does. And you're talking about Brent Turvey, who was the criminalist that was hired by Ann Taylor. I don't think that it does, but it's not up.
I would hope not.
Side. Yeah. I mean, it's, look, people accuse me all the time because I'm a defense attorney and I've got my channel over there. They're always saying, oh, you think everybody's in this bullshit.
No, you don't.
I learned a lot about you. I learned a lot about defense attorneys, and you've made me a fan of them, Bob. You are a purveyor of justice, ensuring that the system works so that everyone gets that fair trial, that we uphold the Constitution. I mean, I listen to your stuff because it's your favorite time and my favorite time.
Nailed
it's
it,
definition too. Time.
I mean, look, if we want to, like, there's nothing more that we want than to feel secure in the convictions that we get at trial. Right.
Yes.
And the only way that you can feel secure is by knowing that everybody did the job right. That the cops did the job right, that the prosecutor did the job right, that the defense attorney did the job right. If one of those parties fails, then the system has failed and due process has not been had, and you've got to go back and you've got to do it again. No one wants to put families and victims through a second trial. It's a fucking nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare, and people lose sight of that. People are just, I call them the torch and pitchfork crew who just run around, with torches and pitchforks, screaming guilty, guilty, hang them. I don't give a shit about trials. Well, you don't want to live in a country that doesn't have due process. I promise you.
Yeah.
I promise you. Ultimately, at the end of the day, do I think this has legs? No. Can I be wrong? Sure. I can.
Have stranger things happened? Yeah, exactly. Broken Plea, obviously, the title of that book. It's the term that he uses in his handwriting. You brought up earlier, he has broken privilege by coming out and saying Ann Taylor did a shit job in not so many words and that he was lied to and blah, 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 blah. Now that he's broken privilege, What has that opened the door to in terms of what Ann Taylor can talk about publicly?
About, what's that mean?
About what? About the conversations that were had behind closed doors. Because if there's anybody who was close to Koberger, unlike anybody else, who would have heard his inner workings, his inner thoughts of him participating in his own defense in the years leading up to the trial that never was, how much do we get to hear? Does Ann Taylor get to write the tell-all book now?
I mean, essentially.
Yay!
Actually, I mean, like, whether or not she'll do it is that's what I was talking about. I mean, she strikes me as a defense attorney's defense attorney. Meaning,
sure, but she's got to. I see nothing wrong with standing up for yourself when your client that you dedicated that much of your life and your reputation to, cousin, throws you under the bus. Is there anything wrong with at that point coming out and saying, "No, that's not how it went down"?
No, and look, at the end of the day, how much she'll disclose or not disclose is going to be up to her, but I mean, she's certainly going to protect her integrity and what she did in the job. You know, I mean, if you look at it ostensibly just from the outside looking in, I mean, the woman litigated the shit out of that case.
Yeah.
She filed every motion that needs and is required to be filed in the death penalty case. I mean, she came up with some of the most novel arguments in terms of attacking the statutes, that I had ever seen. I was always like, oh, I think Ann Taylor's been sitting on this argument for 20 years, waiting for the perfect case to come up where I can attack this particular Idaho statute. And she did. There is no part of me that believes that Ann Taylor sold her client down the river.
No.
I think what the conversations that took place are that simply put, because people keep pointing to Ann Taylor saying, early on in the case before she got into all the discovery, when she says, my client's innocent, Your Honor, when she said that, and people like to hang their hat on it. Well, then she started looking at all the evidence, which even as trial was approaching, she was still saying, I haven't gotten through all the evidence. I'm concerned, which could be another thing that that Koberger could hang his hat on, in terms of she had said, like, I'm concerned about ineffective assistance because I haven't gotten through everything because there's so much of it, know, and the judge, Hippler, was like, look, we're going to trial on this damn thing. So,
what are the next steps here? Where could it possibly go? I think that's what everybody wants to know is, does this end up in a courtroom in some sort of a hearing? Is this just end in things being filed and dismissed? What happens next, Bob?
Theoretically, it should end up in front of Hippler again. It's basically a post-conviction act type petition where he's petitioning the court. I've got a dear friend who's a habeas lawyer who knows that process far, far better than I do. I don't do habeas work, but that's in the federal system. I believe that this will ultimately end up in front of Hippler ultimately, and that petition will get filed. He's got these attorneys; they'll flesh out his arguments. They'll file, and there's timing, time frames on it that are going to have to be abided by. But and then obviously the state will have its opportunity to challenge that. And then ultimately it'll go in front of a judge, and a judge is going to decide whether or not it warrants taking the next step, and it's like, so post-conviction work has stopped. So, ultimately at the end of the day, I don't know how far it's going to go. Like in my estimation, it's not going to make it past the first step.
Yeah. So, if Hippler tells him to go pound sand, is that just the end of it, or can he appeal that further? Can he go anywhere else, or is it just like, nope, you hit another brick wall, Brian?
I mean, it's pretty much good. I mean, he can appeal it up, but ultimately it's going to probably end with the same result. And then whether or not he's got the ability to come with some kind of habeas petition is a different story altogether. But look, people just need to understand this is the biggest mountain to climb.
Yeah,
because he pled in open court. He admitted guilt in open court. And it's like, you just can't walk that back on that. My lawyer.
Is it even more difficult than if you were appealing a verdict? Because obviously this never went to trial. He pled, they get convicted, they appeal that. This is just asking for the trial that he already waved away. It's like, no, I changed my mind. I want the trial.
is this even more difficult
after the fact? You know, it's not timely. That's the other part of it. This is not a timely thing. Like, if I would have had to have been done in 30 days, I'm looking to withdraw my plea. This is 13 months after. And again, this isn't a verdict.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is him in open court having been admonished by the judge as to his rights. And he made his admissions. He admitted guilt. He said that I did the things that they did. And now he's going to, like, because, like, I don't know how you're walking that back. You know, and I've seen some chatter that there was some talk of an Alford plea. And an Alford plea is essentially where you're saying, I'm going to plead guilty. I'm not admitting that I did it. But I do admit that the state has enough to probably get a conviction if it were to go to trial. Like, I haven't seen any proof or evidence, because I think the family was saying that.
Yeah.
Like that either the defense was asking for it or the state had offered it, which would blow me away. Somebody needs to prove to me that Bill Thompson offered an Alford plea to Brian Koberger before I give that thing anything oxygen or any kind of oxygen at all. You know, because that like the families would just, their heads would have exploded.
Yeah.
If that was even a possibility. Because that's basically allowing him not to go into court and do what he did. Say, I did it. I did it. You know, so.
I got one more on this. Do you think he had, because obviously he's throwing Ann Taylor under the bus on this whole thing. So I'm highly doubtful he went over to Ann and said, hey, I'm going to file this in my own handwriting. What do you think? I don't think there was any sort of review by her in terms of a legal capacity. When you read that, other than Brian going to a thesaurus and thinking he's the smartest person in the room, do you think there was any sort of legal consultation that was done before calling the New York Times and filing this?
No, I don't. No. I think that he just went to whatever law library they had there, pulled the book, took months to draft it, and then fired it out, or whatever Whitcomb's book came out. I don't think any lawyer was, you know, maybe some lawyer who wants to throw his hat in the ring and get some notoriety, like send him a letter. Who knows?
I don't know.
It probably wasn't on his own initiative. So most likely, you know, in order for him to get a book in prison, it has to come directly from the publisher. I'd imagine one of the Koberger fans out there had one sent to him, and he's like, oh man, here's my one key to freedom, or just to attention, so I can get better bananas. Really, because when you have no information left to use as currency because you suck so bad, you're going to get attention somehow. So I think that's why I did it. But Bob, really quick, I wanted to go back to your definition stuff. We're talking about this all happened because, well, not a result of what happened. He had a broken privilege. Can you, a little granular there, what does it require, at what level is it considered broken privilege so that Ann now is released to chat as well? Like, what did he do specifically that was broken privilege?
Well, I mean, essentially he challenged her integrity in terms of claiming that she did certain things. So what that does in terms of conversations that were had or not had. So in privilege is held exclusively by the defendant. Like it's the privilege, like a lawyer can't say I'm waiving privilege.
Right.
Only the defendant can do that. And when you say, all right, well, Ann Taylor didn't do this or didn't do that. Well, Ann Taylor, that's essentially going into attorney client communications. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which is where privilege lives, when the defendant is going ahead and saying, okay, well, I'm going to start talking about things that either she told me or she didn't tell me. Then you're talking about privilege, and for all intents and purposes, it's been waived. So whether or not they're going to litigate how far she can go, that's probably a thing that'll happen in terms of, you know, has privilege been completely shattered? I don't know, you know, because it's a pretty bare bones thing that he wrote. So, I mean, that's going to play itself out. But essentially, if just look at it this way, if a defendant is going to go out and say, my lawyer said this, or my lawyer said this, well, then you've broken privilege and you've waived it to a certain extent. I don't know that what he wrote in that particular petition, if it shatters privilege completely, but it certainly gives Ann Taylor the opportunity to be able to respond
at least within the scope of which he spoke.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. Thanks, Bob.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation right there. The links are in the description. Defense Diaries, that is Bob's podcast. That's Bob's YouTube channel. Go check it out. Press subscribe. And Buried, inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation. Did I say
nailed it? You nailed it.
Damn. All
you
right.
You
got
to do it. You want an education on absolutely everything. It is the one-stop shop for true crime on every single aspect, with understanding the law, understanding how things work behind the scenes, and witness tapes, interviews. You get it's the full package, with Bob doing an amazing analysis throughout with unexpected outcomes, surprises. It's better than any Netflix thing you'll ever watch.
And he'll sell you Amway while you're reading, while you're listening. You're like, holy shit. I'm an Amway.
Yeah, I know. I'm a fanboy.
He's that good. Do go check it out. Buried, inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation, wherever you get podcasts. Great, great listening, especially if you're trying to get like one more summer road trip in here. Get that before you hit the road and listen to it. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books. Go check it out. Leave a review on Amazon. That is much appreciated. All right. That's going to wrap it up for today. Until next time, for Bob, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's move over to another case that we have been talking about, and another case that has some interesting writings coming out of it this week. Brian Koberger thread said three words, you remember, last year at sentencing. I respectfully decline. Before that, the only words anyone heard from him in the courtroom were yes, no, and guilty. He has been silent for 3.5 years, and then from a segregated cell at the Idaho Maximum Security Penitentiary, he sent a statement to the New York Times through his family. We're going to read that statement here today. There's also the actual filing that he wrote in his serial killer handwriting. That's another piece of writing. It's very similar in nature, but we're going to go through the one that was actually sent through the Times to the Times directly from the Times. Going to read directly from the text that Brian Enten had posted. Your thoughts in the comment section as we work our way through this. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author of The Minds of Mass Killers, is with us, as is Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent and chief of the counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Okay, here we go. The words of Koberger. I feel like I should do this on the phone.
Got a little pop here.
Because it just seems like over a year later.
He's on a bat phone.
It is self-evident. I'm just going to read it normally. Over a year later, it is self-evident, because Koberger likes to speak in big words as if he's, you know, oratoring something very important. It is self-evident that in State v. Koberger, justice was not served. Unanswered questions seem to multiply with each piece of discovery unleashed, and the public demands the truth. It's almost kind of like a movie trailer. Unfortunately, the truth shall never be derived from the state's myopic narrative, a work of fiction which has yet to evolve since the PCA was released nearly 4 years ago, and its faulty premises were never challenged at trial. Circumnavigated by a broken plea, the trial never provided the public the clarity conductive to closure, and justice shall remain abjectly miscarried unless that plea is withdrawn. Withdrawn, I tell you! I added that part. I hereby declare my intention to enter a not guilty plea and welcome the state the opportunity to prove their case at trial, as well as to again file for the death penalty. My actual innocence is my truth. And the plea, hinged on by false promises and blatant disinformation, must be withdrawn.
Thank you for all who believe in my innocence and continue to critically analyze the case. I send my love to my family who have never wavered in their belief in who I am. Their belief in my innocence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bravo.
Henry Siobhan, what the hell was that?
This is the hour. As I've said before, this use of language is how he got into a PhD program, right? Because they like to see applications where people write like that. It's BS thick. It's painful to listen to. On one hand, very comedic, and on another hand, it's like, oh my God, the narcissism here, and the cluelessness that, you know, people are going to believe this at this point. Although apparently there are some people who want to believe it. Just glaring, putting the spotlight back on himself. The impression management of what a great person he is and how unfair this whole thing has been, because of course he's innocent. Not really, but you know, that's what he wants to communicate. And he has too much time on his hands. You know, this is what he sits around thinking about, is how can I craft this perfect, you know,
tweet here. Clarice, I see in the comment, Clarice. Yeah, yeah. Robin, your thoughts on little Bri's ramblings?
I feel so inhuman every time I take pleasure in him suffering, and every time I read something from him suffering, I just like rejoice. I did a deeper search on it too to see what language, because he's a copycat. He's not an original thinker in absolutely anything. And this entire thing, the title of it, and a lot of the language from it is derived from the book Broken Plea, because he is nothing in life but a copycat, subhuman being, again, you know, abhorrent genetic bucket of goo, as we've said. And as the Gonsalveses continually say as well, because everything he says in there was cut and pasted from something else, all to support his own personal narrative of how he's suffering behind bars. And someone wrote a book that was hearsay because he got it from someone else, didn't do due diligence on anything, and Koberger ordered it from, because it's got to come directly from the publisher, or someone sent it to him, one of his neocons that's like on his side, sent him a copy. He's like, here's my ticket to freedom, and I'm going to cut and paste and claim this as my laurels as to why I got to do this. So you can't even analyze it, because to me, it's just it's a cut and paste conglomeration of stupid goo.
Mm-hmm. Is this, you know, you've obviously, Siobhan, you've analyzed a lot of people in the book, The Mind of Mass Killers. This is what it is, everybody. If you're looking for it on Amazon, highly suggest checking it out. Is this something you think we're going to continue to see out of him every time somebody writes a book that's questioning the case for clicks, basically, or for readers? Because there's going to be more books that are going to come out that are going to go down the conspiracy route. And I'm going to guess everyone he's going to try and latch onto. Is this just the first of many ramblings that we're going to hear out of this guy until somebody finds a broomstick and does what the state of Idaho failed to do?
I think that's a really good guess, because he doesn't have anything else to do other than try and externalize all responsibility and paint himself as a victim. And that's going to be, he's trying to take control of the narrative. This is his story now. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's going to stick with. And he'll probably, you know, spend the rest of his life trying to do that.
What's your take on, he's arguing in the more formal document that he wrote to the courts, that his confession was coerced, basically. He was pressured into it, essentially, because Ann Taylor told him how icky death row could be, and how nasty and spooky and scary and bad it could be. And now he's like, maybe it's not that bad. I think she would kind of maybe overplay that a little bit too negatively. Also saying, my family was there. My family was part of that decision as well. And now it appears he kind of regrets that they were part of that decision, that he listened to Ann Taylor while at the same time thanking them for being supporters of him the whole way through. I mean, it's almost like contradictory in some ways with the family involvement. What was your read on that?
Yeah, it also made me think how much of this is trying to please his family.
Yeah.
He is probably desperate for emotional support because he knows 99% of the world hates him. And that may be hard for him to live with. And if his family is truly standing by him and saying that they believe he's innocent at this point, is he performing for them as well as these, we'll just say, crazy supporters who are very eager to believe that this is all a conspiracy. And I think also for people like that, it makes them feel important, you know, that they're on his team and this whole thing has been unjust. And that's a really weird mind that goes there, but there are a lot of people with weird minds.
You know, Siobhan, my question is, he didn't have a lot of time, thankfully, to move into the world from mass killer to serial killer, although I think all the workings were there for it. And part of that serial killer mindset with most of them is a fantasization part of it, the fantasy part of it. And I'm curious, do you think that him saying this wasn't the Rose Garden I was promised behind bars, you know, because he thought himself to be, I mean, you can imagine him saying and buying into, I'll plead because, oh, I can be an object of study. I can work with Ramslin and then she can study me and make papers about me and I can still pursue my academic credentials behind bars. And you can see this fantasy going on in his mind because he's got nothing else. Is that what do you think might be going on in the fantasy world, or is it something else?
I think that's a really good guess because, yes, serial killers are driven by fantasy. And I agree that this was the path he was going to take. If he had not been caught, he would have done it again. And fantasy is a huge part of how he copes with the world, you know, being a person with really so little going for him. That this is very important to him now.
And he's got no other currency available to him. He's got nothing. It was all exposed right there in court at the sentencing. Four lives tragically lost, and for all these other sick MFers out there, they always had more to work with because they knew they did more. But him just being an abhorrent bucket of goo, he's got nothing else. And so he's got to grab on to anything he possibly can in that fantasy world. And so I think anytime the world gives him any kind of platform, it's horrendous. But at the same time, I think it makes him suffer more because he's never going to get his way.
He didn't mention the victims at all in the letter. I mean, if you truly did not do this, and you're wanting to find justice, you'd think maybe you'd bring them up of like, I want justice for them too. It would be even more insulting and infuriating if you were to say that. But if that's truly where your heart is at, you might throw that into the letter. What do you think about some of the people who were mentioned in it, and where their head might be at and what their reaction, pure conjecture, might be after getting the text, I'm sure, you know, on a Tuesday, like, hey, look what your little boy did. Like, oh my God. I wonder. I mean, it's one thing if you do believe that he's innocent, and I get it. Some families are going to be there no matter what. They could have a video of him doing it, and some people could be like, I don't think that was him. I have no idea what their thought process is. I'm not trying to insert that, and I'm not trying to say they've done anything wrong or are hiding anything whatsoever. They, in many ways, are victims of Lil Bri as well. But what if they're not on his team, if they're not thinking, yeah, he's just was railroaded here. what should they be doing at this point? Because he's clearly trying to lasso them back into his orbit publicly, whether they seemingly want to be or not. Is this something, you know, as if you were the therapist for a sister, a father, a mother, somebody in this sort of situation, and their child from behind bars does a stunt like this, and they're trying to go, what the hell do I do now? What do you tell them?
Oh, you know, they're still sending him money, right?
Yeah.
Large amounts of money every week, which that is the first thing I would look at. What turns into rescuing and validating something that's ultimately incredibly sick and distorted? And I'm always a believer that reality is the best course. But people tell themselves the stories they need to fall asleep at night. And mm-hmm. I can see it being very possible that they're not wanting to believe it's true. And so, you know, yes, you want to guide people gently into the truth, but that can sometimes take a while. So that would be my approach.
Yeah, Siobhan, I know we've really analyzed Asa Ellerup on this kind of stuff because of her dealing with Rex and her struggles to come to face reality, and her therapist, who wasn't actually licensed at the time, which is another friggin' amazing story into itself, right? So I know you probably can't answer this, but I'm just curious. I'll ask it anyway. So what would the behaviors of his mother look like if she did accept the truth of what he did?
If she was able to fully accept it, my guess is it would shake her identity. It would shake her world. And that could be a very big collapse for her. And so I can understand that. In one way, as you have said, Robin, you try to put yourself in the position of these people just to have an empathic response and understand. Hard for me to believe that if I had, my kids are so far from being psychopath narcissists, but if I had a child who did something horrendous, hard for me to see that I would be sending them money and doing anything to try to get them out of, you know, the consequences of what they did. But it would break me. It would break me. I think that would be a very, very hard thing to live with.
From what we've seen on those receipts, it's about $150 a week that Mary Koberger has been sending her son, Brian.
A week? Think about that. Yeah. I don't even go out that much. Yeah. I mean,
allegedly, that's what we understand. Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, so he's getting snack time, as I've called it, you know. And look, I mean, there's certainly plenty of horrendous people behind bars whose family believe full well that they are a horrendous human being who've done horrible things and still support them financially behind bars and put money in the commissary. That's nothing new. That certainly does happen. Not everyone completely cuts that off. I think sometimes people do that for themselves more than they're actually doing it for them out of guilt or whatever might be going on in their mind. What I'm wondering about is, again, this is all pure conjecture here. I'm wondering if Brian's cognitive distortions of reality, which we know are many, if he is distorting this idea that because mom is giving him money for snack time every week, that is somehow supporting his innocence. I don't know. I mean, they probably have conversations and stuff. I have no idea. But I'm wondering if that is the sign and that's what fuels him to think my family is behind me because they're giving me money for Snickers. I don't know. What are your thoughts there?
Sure could be that he you know, misinterprets reality and comes up with his own story. And it's very comforting to have this sense of attachment, you mm-hmm. know, to mom and dad. But my guess is, just based upon what we know at this point, is that they at least are entertaining doubts that he is guilty. And that's you know, their way of coping with it, as somebody put in the comments and what you just said, Tony, how parents can handle horrendous guilt is just moving into denial. And I think whenever a parent has a kid who does something criminal or does something terrible, most parents blame themselves. And in this case, yes, I don't think he was abused as a child. I think he was, you know, from everything we know, well-parented. These were decent people. But something came out wrong in the wiring, which I think for a lot of these people, they're just wired wrong from the beginning. And this may be their way of coping with it is, you know, to try and reframe things that, you know, their kids simply could not have done it.
And there's also another way to think of the commissary money, too. Stuff I watch on TikTok is horrendous sometimes, you know, people behind bars. I watch all these things on Netflix, documentaries, plus interviews myself, you know, so this, so let's, for conjecture's sake, say it's $150 a week. The likelihood and probability, given what we've heard his conditions are like with the torment from the other prisoners behind bars, there's a large probability that $150 isn't going for Snickers for him. It's going to keep people away from him.
But he's in solitary, though. So, I mean, it's not...
Yes-ish, but it's still going to pay off the people around him to keep them silent at night, maybe not from pissing in his food. I mean, in other words, it could be used, it could be given to him to use as currency for a level of security and safety and peace of mind as well. I'm saying there's a lot of ways that people use commissary in prison system. And it might not just be to serve him, because I can't imagine how much... You know, especially being the freakish eater he is, and picky eater, that it can be used for anything you're going to buy in commissary for that. But I could see it being, because I've seen it in many other cases where it's being used to purchase things to give the prisoners around you or send to them to keep them from basically killing him or torturing him unendlessly at night. And so you can imagine. So again, reversing it, as abhorrent as I thought my kid might be. Am I going to send him money to keep him at least alive? If he's telling me I'm under threat of violence, I'm under threat of these things behind bars. So again, there's a lot of, there could be that as well, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, the motivation really might not be, it might not be Snickers as the motivation, right. at least in the...
But it is a tool.
Yeah, and not in the sense of it from the candy bar.
Which makes me feel even better. because the way my mind was working on this one, because I remember just watching the Gonsalveses, thinking while they're giving their impact statements about what they're going to be doing to fueling the commissaries of those people around him, all I'm thinking is that that his mother's trying to balance the wheel on the other side. Because so if you are unlucky enough to be in prison to begin with because you made some horrendous choices in life and you found yourself in the same cell block with Brian Koberger, at this point in life you're thinking, man, we got a lot of commissary coming in from all angles because this guy's a complete nutter.
I mean, if obviously Koberger, he's getting money from people other than his parents. There's pro-burgers that are sending him money, and a good percentage of that goes back to pay the fines and stuff, I guess.
Yep.
But there is a percentage he does get for commissary. But it means more when it's coming from mom, if you will. Siobhan, if mom simply said, you know what, I'm done. I don't want my name on the record here of giving this money. You really went out of turn here and threw us into this mix again. I'm not giving you more money. What happens to Brian Koberger behind bars mentally when if mom or I don't know if she's supporting him mentally or if this is just the conjecture of Koberger, but let's for a moment say that she is and she cuts it off and everybody familial cuts it off. No dad, no mom, no sisters, nobody. What happens to him mentally?
I think it would be a big blow because he's clearly been relying on that attachment, particularly to mom, as a coping mechanism, you know, to try to regulate his emotions. So he would probably suffer more psychologically. But certainly, I think for the family, that would be a healthy thing to do, is disconnect more.
I think we'd see him right into his dog more.
Yeah, probably. So if the family's sitting there and you know, you hear this, you know, from families of people who do horrific things, like, you know, this is horrible. I feel horrible. I wish there was more I could do. Here's what you can do, Mary. Stop feeding him.
Yeah.
The state will feed him. He's not going to starve to death. The rest of the world, he has so bravely marched into through the valley of the shadow of death, using his, you know, biblical large word, you know, dramatic phrasing. And he shall suffer or he shall perish and have eternal life. Whatever the fuck he's going to do. Stop doing it. Stop feeding him. If you want to truly help, here's your one chance you can. You already birthed the monster. You already did whatever that allowed him to get this far. Let's stop. Let's just say stop at this point. And that can be your good deed for life, that everyone doesn't look back upon you for the rest of your life as simply being the mom of Brian Koberger. How about being the mom who cut off Brian Koberger? Mm-hmm. That might be the end legacy that you could live with and others could too.
That's a good one.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We look forward to continuing the conversation right there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you get podcasts as well. We do greatly appreciate it. Siobhan's latest book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Also, The Minds of Mass Killers, available wherever you get books. Go check it out. And Robin's latest, It's Not All About Me, right here. I got a library on the desk. You can get it wherever you get books, audiobooks as well. Leave a review on Amazon. Greatly appreciated. All right. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon. Jeez.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's The Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.